And we're back. Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with John Rappaport from NoMoreFakeNews.com. This is the second hour. We're going to, of course, proceed and talk more about the objective, if you will, of the surveillance state. You have some really interesting points to this, John, that I'm looking forward to getting into. Basically, the ultimate agenda, if you will, if we kind of follow through on where this is taking us now in consideration what we know about the surveillance state, but also how it shapes us, how it forms us, because again, in my view, what I've noticed is we're going from this kind of covert war that people maybe just peripherally kind of knew about. They had an idea about it, but now it's like full out in the open. But what's going on as well at the same time is that nothing is changing. As far as I know, the budget for the NSA is still there. It's still growing. The data centers are being built out. And so what do you make of this? Why is this now being turned into an overt war, pretty much? That's how I see it anyway, John. What do you think about that?
It promotes, to use a phrase that you did off the air before we began, self-censorship, because that's the best way to go if you can. You know, It short circuits and shortcuts a whole lot of systems if you can get people to start censoring themselves. And look at the tie-ins between the Aurora Theater shooting, the Sandy Hook Newtown shooting, the Boston Marathon bombing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then not only the gun legislation, but what's happening in schools all over the country now, where a kid brings a screensaver on his computer that has a picture of a gun on it and he's, you know, suspended. A kid makes an offhand remark during a video game, and he's thrown in jail, 13-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Because he said something, typed out a message, yeah, I'd like to kill someone, blah, blah, blah. Now, all of a sudden, that becomes part and parcel of the culture, because you've got robots running around everywhere, because the natural bureaucratic tendency of people that work inside government and even inside corporations and, you know, school systems, et cetera, they have been trained all their lives to take everything literally. That's what they do. That's the requirement for the job. Can you be stupid enough to take everything literally? You know, is the real interview question. Yes, I can. You're hired. You know, this is what we want.
Yeah.
So now, if I get into a conversation at a little party in the neighborhood, and, you know, we're just shooting the, you know, blah, 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 everybody's just talking, you know, and if I were to say something like, man, that guy should be shot, the reaction of the people, the psychological reaction of the people, is now going to be different than it was 6 years ago, or five, or three, or two. It's going to be noticeably different. And somebody watching me and watching everybody else would be able to see it. The expressions on the faces of the mothers and the fathers and that. All of a sudden it's like, what did he say? That's called censorship. That's beginning to be yet a new level of censorship in a conformist society, where thinking a thought, saying a word, a phrase, no matter in what context, doesn't matter what the context is. Metaphorically, you never heard of it. What are you talking about? Everything is literal. Everything is literal. I've got a real thing about this. I wrote an article, and the title was something like the following: 150 million Americans go to Mexico, swim back, and become instant welfare millionaires. There were people who thought I was reporting an actual news story. 150 million Americans go to Mexico, swim back, become instant welfare millionaires. And not only did they think I was reporting a news story, but some of them were very critical because they said that the story wasn't really true, right? That I was lying.
Yeah, right.
Now, the more literal the mind that you can create in society is, the closer you are to complete and utter control. And to now tie in the surveillance state, if people know that they are being watched and surveilled and snooped on and spied on with video cameras, with this, with that, and they know about emails being, you know, captured and open to being read and phone calls, et cetera, all the way down the line on all levels, drones overhead, satellites, the whole nine yards, right? The tendency for people at that point is to begin to shave off and carve off what they say and even what they think, because this is the culture now. They're living in that culture, and so they don't want to say anything controversial. They don't want to even use words that could be interpreted in a controversial way, and so the literality, the literalness of speech and thought and expression becomes more and more hemmed in as people censor themselves. And this is all part of the agenda of the surveillance state, to create that kind of robotic compliant world. So in a sense, and only in one sense, it doesn't matter what the surveillance state is picking up on American citizens. What really matters is that they're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The details are not important. It only matters that they're doing it. And that is what now invents a new level of culture in society, where everybody is taught to be extremely literal about what they think and say, and to compress it down and reduce it down to acceptable kinds of sound bites.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
You see on the news. That's where we're heading here. And that is an extreme level of mind control.
Yeah. You're right. It's really, really disturbing when you think about it in terms of the self censorship and where that is going in the extension. I mean, even in front of your own property now, your phone, your Android or smartphone, iPhone, what have you, you know, people might whisper or put it in the microwave to act as a Faraday cage to block out the signal, or they take out the battery or cover it up in some way to try to, you know, because they, you know, at this stage even know that they can't maybe speak as they've done before in front of it. They know that it's being monitored and watched. Technology that monitors your, you know, from your heart rate and reads your brainwave patterns, biometrical signatures and everything else. And ultimately, as you say, John, I think that this is also how the landscape that we're living on, everybody, in terms of the media as well, is shaping our morals and our minds, even if we're not aware of it, or even if we are very aware of it. I think it leads to a self-censorship that we might not have thought about yet, or fully understood what the implications of this will be. It's horrible.
That's why I think that theatrical displays of resistance can be beneficial. For example, if you had a high school of 1,000 children and 300 mothers baked cookies in the shape of guns, gave them to their children to take to school on the same day, now something would begin to turn, because that's going to become a story. Now, all of a sudden, people are going to begin to laugh at the whole thing and say, you stupid idiots in the school system, you morons who are trying to make us into robots and androids. This is what we're giving you back. Our level of intelligence exceeds yours by just a bit, and here's the proof. And 300 kids out of their lunch boxes take out cookies shaped like guns. And all of a sudden, the shit hits the fan, and it becomes a furor, you know. Oh my God, and suspensions and arrests and media stories and this and that. And the parents say, very straightforwardly, guess what? We've had enough. We've just had enough of this insanity. Don't try to put this terrorist, mass shooter, this could be a prelude to, you can understand how school officials would react in the wake of, don't try to put all that on us. We're not buying it. You're crazy. We're sane. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, we're going to do it again tomorrow. And the next day. To now begin to say, no, we're not going down that road. And if people have imagination, there are a million things they can think of to do that would begin to expose this trance. But the other thing that I wanted to point out is how these all these events and so on tie in. In other words, the surveillance state and the so-called, you know, random mass shootings and all of these events and so on.
Yeah.
They all play to the same hypnotic center of the psyche. They all play to inducing that trance. They all play to creating a simplistic, reduced down, literal mind. That's what they play to.
You can't use any humor anymore, and I've tried this myself. Even like, you know, if you write an email to somebody or, you know, text message or something, it becomes very increasingly difficult, not only because we lose, you know, all the body language communication and everything else, but you're right, it becomes very, very literal. And even if you make a joke about something, it's not something that comes through anymore. It's like you're talking to a robot as opposed to a human being who has a sense and a, you know, a soul in there.
Exactly. And so the tendency after a while on the part of a lot of people is to just give up. They say, well, I tried, you know, I tried to insert some humor into the situation, and people just aren't biting. So I guess, what am I going to do? Am I going to stand out here all alone looking like an idiot, or am I going to join the parade of the androids? Well, the point is not to do either, but to strike back. And in, for example, the way that I just suggested.
So this is a kind of a, you're talking about a counter strategy to push back the, you know, the political correctness, the liberal insanity, and this kind of terrorist stamp that we've been given from the neocons to the Democrats now, basically.
You bet. Exactly. And unfortunately, whenever I make these suggestions, I get emails from people saying, well, what would you suggest? What should I do? And my reply is, use your imagination. I'm not, you know, I don't head up a Hollywood studio here. You've got to improvise and figure things out for yourself and do them. I mean, I made the suggestion about the schools and the cookies and the guns. You know, that's just an example of how it could be done. There are millions that you could dream up, you know, but that's what's going on here. And this has nothing to do with Ed Snowden or NSA or any of that stuff. This has to do with getting out of a kind of trance state in which you're completely focused on the hero-villain story to where you're actually doing something. And I used to give lots of public lectures, and then I discovered that it was becoming much more difficult to get people to come out of their house at night for anything. And so the audiences were not as large and so on and so forth. It became unfeasible to do a lot of traveling after a while to do lectures. But the thing that I noticed while it was going well was that I could look out in an audience and I could sort of read their state of mind, in the sense of, to what degree are they in a trance of expectation about what's going to happen now that I've walked up on the stage and I'm ready to talk? What are they reading? What are they seeing? What are they expecting? And of course, the level of expectation is normally the lowest common denominator. And I'm using this as a metaphor to talk to people about this kind of mind control. And so my reaction to that was, well, whatever I'm going to do, my primary role up here is to break the trance. Doesn't matter what I say, because there's a lot of information that I could pass along to people that would normally be shocking to them to discover about, you know, reality versus fiction, but it's not going to make a dent on these people because they're in a trance and they're going to absorb everything in that same trance state, and they're going to walk out of here the same as they came in, and I'm not going to let that happen.
Yeah.
Because it would bore me to death to do that from a selfish point of view. So I begin to talk and improvise, and I begin to say things, and with that concept in mind, that my job is to break the trance, all sorts of interesting things begin to happen. The audience starts laughing at stuff, even though they didn't expect to. They begin to look at each other. They begin to go, holy crap, I'm sitting here, I'm alive. You know, this isn't, you know, happening on video, it's real, et cetera, et cetera, you know. And those are among my most satisfying experiences
yeah.
in doing what I've been doing. And that's just a metaphor for everybody's got to be doing that. People who are awake have to do that. You want to get people out of that trance state. That is the fundamental principle of the matrix. You can't have a matrix without that trance state. That's what gives it power. There is no such thing. You can build and devise the most incredible systems and so on and so forth, but if people are not put into a kind of trance state, it's not going to work. And that's the key to the whole thing. And people, you know, they believe, for the most part, even people who want to make change, they believe that it's nigh on to impossible because they just don't see a rational strategy for overcoming the massive society, controlled society in which we live. But that's not the way necessarily to go. Yes, rational strategies are good, fine. I'm not saying don't do that. What I'm saying is think about breaking the trance. If you start thinking in those terms, you're going to come up with all manner of ideas for projects that you can do that are going to be potentially very successful. Very successful. Because people will wake up and they'll say, what was I thinking? What was I dreaming? Why did I think that, you know, that's ridiculous. These people are insane. But they're not, I mean, you can say that in a trance, and you can say that if you're awake, and they're two completely different things. Because trance is not just, you know, literally, I'm in a trance. No. You can be very active and still be in a trance in the core of your consciousness, where you are asleep. But if you're awake and you say, these people are insane, you're going to do something about it. And you're going to be aiming your action at waking them up. And then you're going to have all kinds of ideas that you imagine for how you can do that. How you can do that. And this is, to me, the great unexplored path out of where we are.
Yeah, the potential creativity. Relying on the individual unknown variable in a system that is all about predicting human pattern, predicting, you know, how our from our movements to our actions to our thoughts and everything. And that's also one of the reasons you know, as you just pointed out, that even for a super complex quantum supercomputer that has, you know, yottabytes of, you know, floppy doppy to counter and to calculate everything on, it's still, if there's an unknown variable in there, it won't be able to calculate it, and the prediction will fail, the simulation of the world or whatever they're running will collapse at that point. That's what's so amazing about this.
That is what's so amazing. You're absolutely right. And the other thing we discussed off the air about the surveillance state is that ultimately they're trying to create one universal mind. And I mean that in the sense that if everybody does shave down their consciousness to this literal, reality, then everybody's pretty much thinking the same thing all the time. And that creates a collectivity that is the ultimate goal of the surveillance state. So that one news story, one leak, one release, one order, one executive order, one law, one pronouncement from a key official will have the same effect on everybody at the same time. That's the goal.
Yeah, a monotheistic monoculture where everyone thinks, acts, and looks the same.
Yeah, that's right. That's what you would eventually get to. And that's the ideal form for these people. That's what they're striving toward, because they want control, because that's what they do. That's how they live. That's their psyche. It's all built on that. And once you recognize that, you see that the surveillance state is coming from that impulse. Yes, we want to stop terrorism, we want to do this, we want to do that, and all this stuff, and we can get into the false flags and all that, but that's all just, that's all just distraction. What they're doing is really coming from this impulse to destroy the individual, the free, powerful, independent, creative individual with unlimited imagination, and to replace that with the group, the collective, the mass. They've been after this forever. And they're still after it, only now they're doing it with other means. We're talking about technology here and so on and so forth. So, sometimes, okay, if somebody can find a way to hack into a program that is designed to do surveillance on 100 million people in America that have nothing to do with terrorism or crime or anything like that, and they can hack into that system and expose it and whatever, great, fine, terrific, great. But at the same time, realize that this measure, countermeasure, measure, countermeasure is not the only game in town. That's not the whole story by any stretch of the imagination. Because even some of the people who are doing the counter work, the hacking, they're swept up in the trance as well. Because they haven't been able to wake up enough to see that the real counter strategy to the machine is to be so creative that the machine becomes an object of complete ridicule and scorn and despicability in many people's minds. That's the ultimate solution, if you will.
Yeah.
Just as the ultimate goal of the surveillance state is to create one universal mind, the ultimate goal of the individual is to be so free and so creative and so powerful in his creativity that he can make into fact in the world that which he most desires to create, that the machine is rendered completely useless. So that, to me, if we want to frame this in terms of a versus or a war, that's the war.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good war to be in.
We end up in a stimulus response kind of relationships to the slave drivers, and we just, they instigate the action and then we react to it. And usually that ends up happening as a strategy from their point of view, that they know how we will respond. I mean, they've been studying us for years, if you will, in terms of how to control us. And so the war is on us, is on everybody. And I'll go back to that point I mentioned earlier. It's going from a covert operation into a overt war right now. Because as we know, as you pointed out, terrorism in itself is fake. They don't want to stop it. They do, in fact, all they can to encourage it with from sting operations and entrapments to handing over resources and weapons to those who might be in a position where, you know, they're right at that cusp that they want to do something. You know, we had Julia Davis with us on this program, a former DHS agent, and you know, she basically handed over the details to the DHS that, you know, here's people entering into the United States. You know, they're on these terrorist watches and everything. And what happened is that they turned their eye on her instead and started terrorizing her for exposing the fact that they're letting terrorists into the country so that more and more of these things can happen, because it's through this terrorism that they managed to keep people, just as you said, in a trance, in a fear state, so that they will give up their individuality, they will give up their freedom to an overarching, you know, guiding hand that will keep them safe in this, you know, security, from the point of view of security. So it's a clever tactics, and a lot of people, unfortunately, are falling for that, John.
They sure are. They fall for it all the time. And it is a stimulus response game, you know, as you mentioned there. I've had so many experiences in my own life that prompted me to realize, how can I put this? To expose lies and crimes and so forth is an extremely worthwhile endeavor. And I don't, you know, demean it in any way. But from my personal perspective as a reporter, if that's all that I did, after 5, 10, 15 years, I would burn out completely.
Yeah.
There's no way out, because there's no end. That game goes on forever on its own level unless people get off the train. You know, it's like a train and the tracks never end. And there's the crime and the lie and the exposure and the more crime and the more lie and the exposure and blah, 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 blah. And while you're on the train, yes, you've got to expose the crimes. It's very important. But if you think that that's the only thing that exists, that train on those tracks, then you're going to become burned out, worn out, and you're not going to be able to function anymore. It's not going to work. And I know many reporters to whom that happened in one way or another. And I've also known reporters who, I don't want necessarily mean grown out of it, but they have gone beyond that. And that's been their lifeblood, to be able to go beyond that.
Yeah.
Because they've seen that that's not all that existence is. It's not just stimulus response. Because if you only do that, then, as you say, you're part of their game, because they're predicting what your response is going to be, and they have another one, you know, waiting in the wings.
Yeah,
that's what they do. I don't know whether in my interview that I did on Red Ice earlier, I mentioned this story, but when I first started out as a reporter in 1982, writing for LA Weekly, one of my first assignments that I was handed was to interview this guy named Bill Perry, who was the PR guy for Lawrence Livermore Labs up in Berkeley, California, where they do research on, you know, newer and better nuclear weapons. And Bill was a real interesting guy. And he said to me, the first thing you have to understand is this was my ideal job. He said, this is what I've been shooting for all my life as a PR guy. I was now in charge of all PR for Lawrence Livermore, which meant that I could call a press conference at any time I wanted to. I could rent a ballroom in a major hotel, lay out all kinds of food and drink, and reporters would show up. Anybody I invited would be there, and then I would have these scientists that I had trained from Livermore to be able to communicate to the reporters in a way that they would understand, and they would print their stories. It was perfect, he said. This was the capstone on my career. Well, at that time, the nuclear freeze movement was taking off in America, the freeze on production of new nuclear weapons. And so there were protesters at Livermore, and they became more numerous, and they would stand at the fence. And Bill told me, he said, over time, you know, I couldn't help but notice these people. And I saw that they weren't just a bunch of students from the university. They weren't just a bunch of hippies. There were guys in business suits. There were mothers with their kids. There were all kinds of people. And he said this was beginning to get to me, that I began to see that, you know, I had to change. I had to do something. And then he said, the final straw was one day I was walking through and there was walked into a physicist's office where he was working, you know, whatever doing on paper at the time,
yeah,
mathematics and so forth. And I said to him, how's it going? And he said, terrible. I said, why? He said, because we need more money. We need more funding and so forth. And Bill said, without thinking, I just said, look, man, you can already blow up the world a dozen times over. Why do you need more money? And the physicist looked at Bill and he said very calmly, you don't understand, Bill. This is a physics problem. It's a mathematics problem. As if that was, you know, sufficient to the day to explain exactly why they needed more money, because this guy was, you know, he's on the train. And his job is to do physics and math and to come up with better equations and formulas, et cetera, et cetera. And so he needs more money, and that's the end of the story. You know? That's all you have to know.
Great.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's a good reflection of what goes on there. And you know, another thing there basically also that you're alluding to is that no one else is going to be able to lead you off the train, you know, as you want to go off it, per se, because there are all these, you know, collectivist movements out there that claim this and the other, but I've always been a staunch believer in the individual and the individual's power to choose this for themselves, because as you were talking a little bit about the, you know, the single universal mind and everything else, there's another portion of this that really also plays very well into the hands of, you know, New Age oneness, you know, there's a number of these things that are out there, and it might not always be a bad thing, of course. There's good things within a lot of different, you know, belief systems and everything else, but there's a strong, very, very strong, negative anti-ego and just this pro-oneness New Age ideology out there that's also kind of taking, you know, people by storm in some regard. It's like becomes increasingly, you know, positive. So how do you view that with the lens of, you know, just having talked about this single universal mind? And the negative side of that.
Yeah, you bet. I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to get into that. We're all in this together. You know, over and over we hear this from Obama. Obama is, among other things, you know, like, he's like every other president, okay, in one sense. He's a globalist. And his job, and he's been vetted for this, and it's all well understood before the fact, that all these presidents are basically, their number one job is to do nothing to stop globalism. It's not even something they need to enact. They just have to get out of the way and not be an obstruction to the idea that we're going to have one planet under one global management system forever, and all borders will eventually be erased, and there'll be this super duper bureaucracy over everybody, and the surveillance state will be universal,
yep,
et cetera, all of that.
Yep.
Okay, But in addition to that, Obama is a key figure because, in a way, he represents a version of that universal mind propaganda. We're all in this together. You didn't build that. It's not the individual, it's the group. And he's been positioned to be that, and it's understood that he would do what he's doing in that respect, and that he would present it as a kind of spiritual theology, that he would try to use his oratorical skills to promote that even further, to the point where many people would be completely roped in and hypnotized by it without even thinking about what it means, because when you try to take that phrase apart, we're all in this together, you see that you've got just fragments of nothing in your hand. What does it even mean? And, you know. But that is the way that all of this New Age propaganda has fed directly into a presidency.
Yeah.
And into the surveillance state, because it's only, if you're already in a kind of trance, it's just a short trip down the street between we're all in this together, one universal consciousness, one mind, to we're all thinking the same thing together.
Yeah. Well, John, this is how the what's been called a worldwide mind has been sold. The transhuman dream of a computer brain implant basically is going to lead us down the path of this, you know, synthetic telepathy, no privacy, instant communication, but it's going to be like a religious experience almost, where you're like, you know, you have a literal connection with everyone else. A nightmare to me, if you ask me.
Yeah, complete nightmare. No question about it. Roy Kurzweil is kind of the king of the technocrats in that respect. And the philosophy there, or the thesis of those people, is, of course, that when they produce this brain machine link or brain computer interface, that everybody will have access to everything. But everything means the same thing. You can say, well, it's a trillion times a thousand bits of data that we have stored. And now, as soon as we hook you up, you will have instant access to all of that. And then you say, well, what about the guy that lives next door? Oh, well, he'll have access to the same thing. And what about the guy down the block? Same thing. So in other words, we all have access to the same everything. That's right. And I would presume, you say, that the inferences that I would draw from all of this data, the way that I would wend my way through it and so forth, would be regulated by some sort of a logic program. In other words, so that I can not only access it, but I can think, well, oh yes, well, that's all done for you. So there we have yet another strand of this universal, single, one mind blather, which is, yes, we're all in this together because we're all hooked into the same database of databases.
Yeah.
So these are the several of the vectors that are all pointing in the same direction. And the surveillance state is another arm of that, because that's somebody saying to you, and we're going to guarantee that you all think the same thing at the same time. Because if you don't, you're going to stick out and we'll notice you.
Yeah.
Whether
right.
It's through an email or something you said or mentioned on the phone or whatever it was, we'll notice that. And as things become more and more homogeneous for everyone, then you'll stick out even further. And it won't take departing from the norm very far to raise red flags about you, because if you're standing on a desert where everything is the same, and you're the guy in the landscape on a dune you know, we're going to notice you and we're going to do something about it. So that's how the surveillance state plays into this.
Well, let me ask you this then, because if this also is an interesting point, if this to a certain extent is about kind of coaxing out, if you will, some of these people who have that difference, I mean, what do you think will happen or might could happen to those who don't self-censor in this new surveillance state, those who do not follow orders and the politically correct unwritten laws out there? I mean, if we don't have the numbers with us in one sense, as an individual who try to do something about all of this, while the masses are huddling together, if you will, in fear for being, you know, the one who stands out kind of thing, is there a risk in this? And I think there is, personally, I think it is, and I think that's also a good thing. It has to be a risk in it, right? You can't, there's no other way out of it, is there?
Yeah, it's a risk, but if doing something that turns out to be a risk as defined by the state is actually coming from inside you and is doing something that you truly want to do, then it's not really defined by you as a risk.
Exactly.
And yeah. People have to understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just risk for risk's sake. It's not, well, I don't really want to do anything. I don't have anything to do. So I think what I'll do is, I'll put together a water gun that looks like a machine gun, and I'll walk onto a playground just because, you know,
right. Yeah.
I need some adrenaline. Mm. No. No, I'm not suggesting that. If it comes from your own real creative core, and then whatever you do turns out to be a risk in the desert of conformity, well, so be it. But that's not the way you're looking at it, particularly, because you're living a creative life. You're living through and by imagination. You're not living through and by trance. And then the other thing that I think is connected here and is very important is there are levels of punishment. Peer pressure is the most ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And that works for a whole lot of people. They just sense or feel or even fantasize the existence of peer pressure. That's going to shut them up and shut them down and make them persist in their trance state. If that barrier is crossed, then we have punishment. We have, well, we don't want you in our community. You know, we're going to kick your kid out of school. And therefore, the parents of other kids who are your friends will no longer be your friends because they'll be too nervous to be around you because they know you stand for something else. So that's a sort of a light degree of punishment. And eventually, you know, you could take it up all the way to you're dangerous and you're a potential terrorist, and therefore you need treatment. You haven't actually blown up anything yet, but we know that you're disposed in that direction, and so we're going to put you on a 72-hour hold and lock down in the psych ward where a shrink is going to
administer antidepressants, you're antisocial, etc. Yeah, I got it.
Exactly. Going to drug you into submission, basically.
Yeah.
That's
wow.
What that is. And that's why, incidentally, I've written so much about psychiatry over the years, because, you know, when you take the mask off, that's really what it's all about. It's about control.
Yeah, yeah. Social engineering, and they're expert at it. They know how to form society. I mean, look at how far we've come from, you know, now we don't know everything about our past human beings, but look at how far we've come, how much we've submitted to what's going on in the world today, John. Where is the resistance, really? You know, when you think about it, it's kind of sad.
Yeah, I agree. But I take heart from just knowing that the potential is there to make changes. But yes, you look around and it's, you know, there are things that people just simply knuckle under to now that they never would have 50 years ago. And if you want to go back 100 years, you know, that would never fly.
Yeah, but that's right. Yeah.
It's a kind of a creeping form of gradualism. And I've written before that the greatest innovation, you might say, of the 20th century was organization. It's not that humans were never organized before, but not to the same degree. The study and the practice of organization, the forming of strategies to organize, the size of organizations, the compartmentalizing within organizations, the specializing of function within gigantic organizations, whether they're corporations or governments, to promote efficiency in whatever the goal and the job of these organizations are. And in the process, of course, people have been ground up into powder because they've decided that this is the way they're going to make a living. And so they become part of a hive, a nest, a collective, which is that organization, whatever it is. And they find that over the years, they turn into androids. And I've interviewed a few of these people who worked in significant jobs inside major corporations, for example, to get down to the nuts and bolts of what actually happens there. And in government, it's even worse. But the preposterous stories that they have to tell me about the way things are done, the systems of operation and control and the connection between various departments and so forth and all that goes on there is really a form of, you know, 8-hour-a-day hypnosis.
Yeah.
And anybody who sticks his head up above the water gets it chopped off pretty much. Because, you know, you say, you see this guy over here in this office? If you will look on his desk, you'll see that he is the terminal dead end point for at least 100 pieces of vital data that are being passed up and down, sideways, all throughout the organization, and he's just sitting there basically, finding ways to delay and screw up things and so forth. This, if we fired this guy, you wouldn't believe what would happen. And I knew a person who actually made a study of this. I mean, talk about building a case against somebody. It was, you know, open and shut, man. And her boss said, never going to happen. Never going to happen.
Yeah.
It would be too difficult. We would have this on our hands and that on our hands and pop, 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 pop. So, you know, the super organization of societies has played a major role in this kind of sleep trance that affects so many millions and even billions of people. And it plays right into all the other vectors that we've been talking about here. And that's yet another thing that has to be overcome.
Very good. Oh, by the way, speaking of humor as well as we did before, I just want to mention the guys at Joy Camp do great work on this front when it comes to, you know, utilizing humor to help to wake people up. Kevin and Benny was on Radio 314 with Lana last time. There are a lot of people out there like this, of course, as well, who do some great stuff. Tom Maybe, I think his name is, the comedian who did that boom mic of tyranny, kind of, you know, funny stuff. So there is a lot of good stuff out there happening as well. So I don't want to sound, you know, pessimistic as we talk about this. But ultimately, though, John, if we look at what is at stake here, I guess what's at the other side of this tunnel, you know, that we're heading for right now, if we don't shape up, what are we looking at, do you think? The transformation of mankind into the point that we could, you know, cease to call it that? Or where is this going, do you think?
Well, I think we can see examples of it around us, of people who live in small spaces and work in small spaces inside bigger spaces, inside bigger spaces. You know, and they think small and they act small and they follow the rules and they keep their eyes straight ahead. The robotization, the androidization of the planet is where we're headed. And the technologies that will come into being will be researched and utilized toward that end. And we have, you know, two great examples of that in Orwell's 1984 and Huxley's Brave New World. And I've always argued that 1984 is sort of a stage one and Brave New World is stage two.
Yeah.
In stage two, the idea is if you can get the individual to define their own satisfaction, happiness, joy, life force as something mediocre, if you can achieve that level, then you can supply chemicals, drugs, electromagnetics, whatever, to bring a person back to that level if they fall below it, which is pretty much what you see in Brave New World.
Yeah.
They don't have the drugs, the soma in Brave New World, if you reread that novel, to make people suddenly feel, you know, tremendously and vividly and personally alive. They just, you know, soma, which is supposed to be the universal solvent and cure for everything, really just takes the edge off. And the reason that it's so successful is because people have defined for themselves their own lives, their own life energy and force and power and creative power and imagination at such a low level that satisfaction for them means really so little that you can chemically induce it and you can bring people back to it if they get sad or they're confused or whatever. They go to the dispensary and you can enact all kinds of individual and mass solutions with technology as we would move forward into that dystopia to achieve that, which I think we can see is already in a very crude state what neurology and neurological research and pharmacological and psychiatric research is all about. You know, you start off with something called Thorazine in 1953 or 54, which was introduced into society because a French researcher noticed that if you gave it to rats, they could no longer climb ropes. That was his brilliant insight, right? And so he said, okay, that's what I'm going to do for psychotics. And he did. And now you see a whole parade of so-called antipsychotic drugs and this, and then you get into antidepressants and this and that, and people take these, you know, antidepressants and they go out and they kill people and so forth. Okay, but on goes the research, and eventually you're going to see more and more compounds that, you know, bring a person back to some theoretical baseline. But that baseline doesn't work unless the person as a soul, as a being that is not the same as flesh, it only works if that soul, that you, decides that your own happiness and life vitality is mediocre to begin with, and then when the drug produces that, you say, oh, that's wonderful. I feel fine now.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, many people have, in a way, committed suicide. I mean, they've already given up in that regard. The rest, I mean, with the control and the lack of resistance, I mean, that's not a big surprise, really. I mean, there has to be that drive and that will within the human being to get out of there, or, you know, from the point of view that of not ending up in there to begin with. You know, all these other things we see in the world today are just kind of, they're just you know, reflections, if you will, of a deeper problem, or you know, on the sliding scale of things. That just, it's already happened to a lot of people. They're just not, you know, physically, if you will, and mentally, they haven't just gone there yet, if you know what I mean, John.
Yes. Well, this is why I put these two Matrix collections together, because that's what they're aimed at, is getting people not only to redefine what their own level of vitality and life and joy is, but to be able to, you know, achieve it and beyond. And as I've been writing for the last 10 or 12 years, imagination is really the key. That's the disparaged faculty of the human being that's thought of as only a toy that children play with, and then they grow up and it's time to cast that aside. That's where people put everything that they consider to be impossible for themselves, that is never going to happen, that can't happen. That's the faculty that can create something out of nothing, that can go beyond the cause and effect, serial time aspect of the matrix. That's the arena that is really limitless, in which all the creative power and energy of the individual is stored. And I've seen time and time again how that actually works, and how people recover enormous amounts of energy that they've lost and go on to live completely different lives, a different, you know, level of magnitude and space and so forth. That is what the education system tries to, you know, train
destroy.
Out of people.
Yeah, they're destroying it.
Yep.
Imagination, it's a rare gift, and yet so many people spoil it. I mean, you're right, that is the solution out of this with the, and the, again, I think that would be kind of a bottom-up solution, as opposed to the, you know, the antithesis to the centralized, you know, top-down system that we have right now. That if people began, and I've said this so many times, but basically I put it in the terms of following their own hearts, following their, you know, Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss. You know, it's the same idea there, that if you follow your intention of what you want to do, your inner drive, your creativity and your imagination, there will be incredible things happening on this planet, and things will fall into place in a natural, organic way, in a pattern that we never could have ever planned for in any regard. I think we, in a way, although we need to use our rational mind, we need to be logic and thinking and everything like that as well, we also need to, in certain regard, kind of surrender to the bigger picture of this experience and what this is about, and trust in that there is a natural order, although we might not fully comprehend it and understand it. John, would you agree with that?
Well, I wouldn't use exactly that language. I think we're in basic agreement. But the way that I would put it is, it's unique to each individual. So that makes it a threat to the state. It isn't one size fits all.
Certainly not, no.
And if we could theorize the idea of a million people living out their lives in that unique and powerful way independently, then what we would see is a future in which there is no discernible pattern, no overriding pattern. What we would see is, and one of the great heretics in Western history, Giordano Bruno, who was burned at the stake by the church, really expressed this in his own way quite poetically when he postulated the idea of infinite souls, each one independent, existing side by side, each one in a way pursuing his own infinity.
Yeah.
And if that were to happen, then what would you be seeing in terms of the overall picture? Well, nobody would really be able to predict that, because when you are creating out of the wellspring of your own imagination, there is no prediction. There is expansion of life in all directions. And so we would see, for the first time, a truly open society. That's what we would see.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is, you know, the most worthy of goals.
Well, it's a beautiful way of putting it. And if we just, for a moment, then go a little bit deeper under that, if you will, what do you think that it is that we are tapping into as human beings when it comes to creativity an imagination? Is it something beyond ourselves, or is it a part of ourselves that we, for whatever reason, usually kind of lack connectivity with being on this planet, and specifically maybe under the conditions that we currently live and have been raised?
I would say that it's a part of ourselves, of each one of us, as you described it, that we are, that most people are ordinarily not in contact with. And then what we come to see is that, you know, the individual or ourself is much larger and greater in many more dimensions than we had originally supposed. And it's not that we're isolated from each other, far from it. In fact, when you get independent, free, and intensely creative individuals together, you can get some incredible things happening.
Exactly. That's a good point, because many people see that from the other point of view, that it's self-interest and ego drive, but it's those very things that will get unique individuals to come together with a completely different, you know, there will be a powerful relationship, because the differences, and maybe also the, you know, the need in a way, will actually have a different kind of expression if they would, as opposed to what we talked about earlier, which is the sameness. When everyone is the same, there's no unique, true relationships. It's almost like there's no need for others then, because we're all the same, right?
Exactly. And that produces ultimately the most isolation of all, is when everybody is the same.
Yeah.
That's why you need the Soma in Brave New World. That's exactly why you need it, because people feel this hollowness within themselves that they can't explain or describe, because they're so remote from themselves. And that's the fix. That's the fix. So the critique, the attack against the ego as being something that is isolated, self-contained, selfish, greedy, opposed to humanity, evil, not good, you know, the stereotype of, you know, some sort of captain of industry who's got slaves working for him,
right,
making billions while they're starving.
Yeah.
This is all propaganda that is designed to destroy the concept of the individual. That's what it's there for.
That's right.
That's
yep.
the whole idea of it. And of course, you can point out these negative examples, but that does not add up to a generality about everybody. It certainly doesn't add up to a generality about human potential and what it really means. Quite the opposite. And that's where people not only get confused, but that's where they surrender. That's where they think that it's the most advanced kind of thinking to be all part of the same group and the higher elevation of consciousness where we're all one together and so forth and so on. And that is like the fairy tale about something that could actually exist among free, powerful, independent, and intensely creative individuals. But that's a whole different universe. The propagandized version is where you give up. You sell your soul, and you say, yes, we all need to be the same, and we all need to sing the same song all the time, and then everything will be okay, and this will really be spiritual, and it'll be wonderful, and this is what I've been looking for all along. And so eventually, not only do you get a super organized beehive of planet Earth, where everybody is in his little cubicle, but you also get this mass sort of delusion of ultimate spiritual consciousness, which does not exist, which is just, it's a fairy tale that's been sold over and over again in various guises, and people keep buying it because it's easier. Because it's easier. Because the other way is you say to yourself, what is it that I truly desire? And being able to find that and then to create it, imagine it in its fullest flower and create it in the world, that seems to be just way too much for most people.
Yeah.
It's too much of a risk. They say they can't do it. They don't understand it. They don't know what it means. They'll say anything to sidestep it and avoid it. The easiest way to avoid it is to say, we're all in this together, and we have to all be singing the same song together.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, think about this, people. They do not want independent, capable people that can mend for themselves, that are self-driven and self-directed. I mean, just think about the morality of self-sacrifice that were sold in specifically the movies these days. It's unbelievable if you look at it, the subtextual, well, not even that, it's just straight in the open in most cases, but it's, you're right in that way, John. That is sold as a religious kind of experience. I mean, and the fact is you have to stand on your own feet and mend for yourself and create what you want to have created. Otherwise, you become dependent, and that's why it's so serving to the powers that be, and that's why this is the morality that we're being sold at this moment, because it you know, gets you to give this up, you know? Very important point.
I wrote an article, I don't know, 10 days ago or so, called The Most Frequently Used Words on Television. And the only study I could find was a partial study done by Wiktionary of all television shows, scripts in the year 2006. They weren't able to get all the scripts, but they got a lot of them. And they got 29 million plus different words. 29 million.
Wow.
And 250 or so from the top was family. So that leaves a whole lot of words less frequently used on television than family. And I've been watching that word evolve for the last 15, 20 years on television, in ads, in shows. Family's everything. You know, when you cut away everything else, all you're left with is family. Be part of the family. Don't desert the family. Don't betray the family. The family is everything. Whether you're watching crime shows or sitcoms or ads or the news or some kind of sob story on a talk show or whatever, keeps coming back to that over and over and over again. As if, in the whole history of humankind, nobody really understood what family was until now. This is, we really have to do an education job on the public here, because, you know, even though everybody's born from a mother in some kind of a family, good, bad, or indifferent, people just don't know how important family is, and we're going to have to shove it down their throats. And this is kind of the entry point into collectivism, into the collective. If you can get people to buy the idea that family is everything, whatever that means, then you can introduce them to the wider notion that the collective is everything, that society is really a collective, that, quote, we're all in this together all the time, that that's the ultimate degree of consciousness. And that takes you completely away from the individual. And as I think I mentioned in the last interview that I did on Red Ice, the operation here, the covert op, is to erase not only individuals, but the idea of the individual from society, from history, from culture, from everything, from education, so that people only vaguely remember it, if at all, only vaguely remember what it meant, if anything, and that it would be presented as kind of a construct that the human race once needed in a phase of its evolution, but now it's really gone extinct and we don't need it anymore because we've gone beyond it. We've advanced to the level where we see that we're all really one and we're all a group, and so that idea goes extinct. And I actually found a quote by a sociologist at a university in a paper that he wrote where he just says that, basically. The idea of the individual is a delusion. It doesn't exist. The individual does not exist. He just says it, as if he's not going to have a problem with that. And he didn't have a problem with that. He wasn't fired, or nobody came into his office and said, are you sure you don't need a pair of glasses? Because I see a lot of individuals. No, nobody, nothing. Fine, no problem. And in fact, sociology and anthropology are twin pseudosciences, which are really propaganda operations that developed out of psychological warfare research. And they, along with something called mass communications research, which is another pseudo category, that thrives and thrives at universities because they're all part of collectivist propaganda aimed at showing people that groups need to be studied and understood, but the individual has been phased out.
Yeah. Wow. And today as well, this is, you know, even trans, you know, family has transformed as well. Today it's, you know, the new normal, modern family and such. And you know, from my example, Sweden has also gone through this transformation where, you know, even anymore, not the family is not even there anymore as that unit. I mean, it's like they don't see you as an individual, but larger, the best comparison I can make is like an ant in the larger kind of society. It's just you and the state. And we can kind of see this in the, you know, P.P. Longstocking's role model. And there's some funny articles on this out there that kind of just pointed out that this, you know, you have a girl who lives with her horse and her monkey and that's it. And then it's like, then it's the state kind of thing. So we have to be careful, you know, where this is taking us as well and how they're transforming all the time these concepts, John, that has been like in existence for thousands of years. And now it's being, you know, slowly kind of molded away, and we're being turned into, well, I compare it to an ant society, and collectivism is at the core of that, and that's why I see it's so dangerous, because it's the destruction of the individual and all the things that you've been talking about so eloquently when it comes to the importance of that.
Well, yeah, these are the important things to me. These are bottom line things. They can't be ignored. They have to be faced up to, they have to be dealt with, and the future is riding on it.
Indeed, I do agree. Well, John, let's begin to wrap things up here for this time. We've gone for a long time here in the second segment, and very good that we did that because we got some really good stuff out here, and I've been thoroughly enjoying this conversation with you, John, and I hope we can have you back at some point and talk more, of course, as we begin to, you know, round things up for this time. A lot of things are unfolding in the world, and we're going to keep on monitoring the NSA story as well and see where that goes. But just as you said, that, you know, be aware of the train and where that takes you. But why don't we round things up again, John, with you giving out your details and tell us where people can go on the website to find the Matrix, you know, packages and all that.
Yes, I've really enjoyed this conversation too. NoMoreFakeNews.com is the website. And they can see everything there. They can see the Matrix revealed, Exit from the Matrix, read descriptions of them. They can order them. And they can see my articles that I write on a very regular basis and stories that I'm covering in my blog and so on and so forth. It's all right there. And, you know, my articles are being published by other websites and so forth, but they can also just get the latest articles there at the website at No More Fake News, and they can go into the blog and scroll back and see earlier stories and sign up for the email list so they can get the stories right in their email box, and that's the easiest way to do it.
Very good indeed. Yeah, do follow John's blog as well. Some great stuff coming out there, writing very often, of course. So very good. Great having you with us. NoMoreFakeNews.com. That's the website. Thanks again, John. We do appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. I'm glad we took the time and stretched out on this.
That's our program for today. Great perspective from John Rappaport. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for listening. We could not do this without you. This is a listener-supported endeavor. And as we expand into new territory to bring you more productions, more content, more insight, we want to say thank you for staying with us here in the members section. Much more coming up. James Bamford, Lennon Honor, Adrian Salbucci, Jeffrey James, Larkin Rose, and many more are coming up. I hope you have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll speak to you in just a few days, so do take care. We'll talk to you later.